Side 1, The Boat of a Million Years, by Powell Anderson. Copyright 1989 by Powell Anderson. All rights reserved. Narrated by Mitzi Friedlander. This book contains 470 pages on 15 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. Immortal humans live through Earth history and then explore space. Early in human history, several men and women are born who, after living their normal lifespan without aging, live on. But in 20th century America, their secret of immortality becomes known. Once everyone on Earth becomes immortal, the men and women must search for new challenges, challenges that take them to outer space. 1989. From the book jacket. For 40 years, Paul Anderson has been among the great names of science fiction. His famous stories and novels have won the Hugo and Nebula Awards many times and remain standards of achievement in the SF field. Now, after nearly a decade of collaborations, Paul Anderson has written a major SF novel all his own, the biggest book he has ever written, spanning the whole history of the human race on Earth and out among the stars. The Boat of a Million Years is, like Frank Herbert's Dune and Robert A. Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, a landmark book and a great career, a work of such ambition that it will be seen as the capstone of its kind in science fiction. Others have written on the theme of immortality, but Paul Anderson makes it his own in this novel. Early in human history, certain unique individuals are born who live out their normal span without aging and live on, undying. We follow several of them as individuals for more than 2,000 years, for they do not band together, but survive as loners. Hanno, the Phoenician, is an explorer and adventurer who travels and learns. Dushan is an Oriental sage. Rufus is a Roman oaf who becomes Hanno's sidekick for more than 1,000 years. Aliat and Svoboda are women who survive by sexual favors or strength. Through their adventures, we skim human history until, at the end of the 20th century, their immortality is revealed, and the whole human race begins a research program that finally attains the miracle of eternal life, and thus a utopia on Earth is created. But the few natural immortals, the survivors of history, find themselves alienated from this new humanity, perfect, unchanging. And so they band together for the eternal adventure of space exploration. The Boat of a Million Years is a milestone in the evolution of contemporary science fiction, sophisticated, historically accurate, panoramic, thoughtful, and moving. It is a triumph. About the author. Paul Anderson lives in Orinda, California. Other books by Paul Anderson. Conflict, The Gods Laughed, The Guardians of Time, Hoka, with Gordon R. Dixon, A Midsummer Tempest, New America, No Truce with Kings, Past Times, The Psychotechnic League, The Saturn Game, Tales of the Flying Mountains, Time Wars. Acknowledgements. Chapter 3, The Comrade, has appeared in Analog Science Fiction, Science Fact, June 1988. Copyright 1988 by Davis Publications, Incorporated. Chapter 5, No Man May Shun His Doom, does homage to the late Johannes V. Jensen. Karen Anderson prepared the epigraph, slightly modifying her translation at my request, and as scholar and critic was invaluable throughout. The Vesssr is due to George W. Price. For other kinds of help, I also thank John Anderson, Victor Fernandez Davila, and David Hartwell. Dedication to G.C. and Carmen Edmondson. Salud, amor, dinero y tiempo para gustarlos. May he go forth in the sunrise boat. May he come to port in the sunset boat. May he go among the imperishable stars. May he journey in the boat of a million years. The Book of Going Forth by Daylight. Theban Recension, circa 18th Dynasty. Chapter 1. Thule. 1. To sail beyond the world. Hanno's voice faded away. Pythias looked sharply at him. Against the plain, whitewashed room where they sat, the Phoenician seemed vivid, like a flash of sunlight from outside. It might only be due to the brightness of eyes and teeth, or a skin tan even in winter. Otherwise, he was ordinary, slender and supple, but of medium height, features aquiline, hair and neatly trimmed beard, crow's wing black. He wore an unadorned tunic, scuffed sandals, a single gold finger ring. "You cannot mean that," said the Greek. Hanno came out of reverie, shook himself, laughed. "Oh, no, a trope, of course. Though it would be well to make sure beforehand that enough of your men do believe we live on a sphere. They'll have ample terrors and troubles without fearing a plunge off the edge into some abyss." "You sound educated," said Pythias slowly. "Should I not? I have traveled, but also studied. And you, sir, a learned man, a philosopher, propose to voyage into the sheerly unknown. You actually hope to come back." Hanno picked a goblet off the small table between them and sipped of the tempered wine that a slave had brought. Pythias shifted on his stool. A charcoal brazier had made the room close as well as warm. His lungs longed for a breath of clean air. "Not altogether unknown," he said. "Your people go that far. Lycius told me you claim to have been there yourself." Hanno sobered. "I told him the truth. I've journeyed that way more than once, both overland and by sea. But so much of it is wilderness, so much else is changing these days, in ways unforeseeable, but usually violent. And the Carthaginians are interested just in the tin, with whatever other things they can pick up incidental to that. They only touch on the southern end of the Prytanic Isles. The rest is outside their ken, or any civilized man's. And yet you desire to come with me." Hanno, in his turn, studied his host before replying. Pythias, too, was simply clad. He was tall for a Greek, lean, features sharp beneath a high forehead, clean-shaven, with a few deep lines. Curly brown hair showed frost at the temples. His eyes were gray. The directness of their glance bespoke imperiousness or innocence, or perhaps both. "I think I do," said Hanno carefully. "We shall have to talk further. However, in my fashion, like you in yours, I want to learn as much as I can about this earth and its peoples while I am still above it. When your man Lycius went about the city inquiring after possible advisers, and I heard, I was happy to seek him out." Again he grinned. "Also, I am in present need of employment. There ought to be a goodly profit in this." "We are not going as traders," Pythias explained. "We'll have wares along, but to exchange for what we need rather than to get wealthy. We are, though, pledged excellent pay on our return." "I gather the city is not sponsoring the venture?" "Correct. A consortium of merchants is. They want to know the chances and costs of a sea route to the far north now that the Gauls are making the land dangerous. Not tin alone, you understand. Tin may be the least of it, but amber, furs, slaves, whatever those countries offer." "The Gauls, indeed." Nothing else need be said. They had poured over the mountains to make the nearer part of Italy theirs. A long lifetime ago, war chariots rumbled, swords flashed, homes blazed, wolves and ravens feasted across Europe. Hanno did add, "I have some acquaintance with them. That should help. Be warned, the prospects of such a route are poor. Besides them, the Carthaginians." "I know." Hanno cocked his head. "Nevertheless, you are organizing this expedition." "To follow knowledge," Pythias answered quietly. "I am fortunate in that two of the sponsors are more intelligent than most. They value understanding for its own sake." "Knowledge has a trick of paying off in unexpected ways," Hanno smiled. "Forgive me. I'm a crass Phoenician. You're a man of consequence in public affairs. Inherited money, I've heard. But first and foremost, a philosopher. You need a navigator at sea, a guide and interpreter ashore. I believe I am the one for you." Pythia's tone sharpened. "What are you doing in Massalia? Why are you prepared to aid something that is not in the interests of Carthage?" Hanno turned serious. "I am no traitor, for for I am not a Carthaginian. True, I've lived in the city among many different places, but I'm not overly fond of it. They're too puritanical there, too little touched by any grace of Greece or Persia, and their human sacrifices. He grimaced, then shrugged. To sit in judgment on what people do is a fool's game. They'll continue doing it regardless. As for me, I'm from old Phoenicia, the East. Alexandros destroyed Tyre, and the civil wars after his death have left that part of the world in sorry shape. I seek my fortune where I can. I'm a wanderer by nature anyway. I shall have to get better acquainted with you, Pythias said, blunter than he was wont. Did he already feel at ease with this stranger? Certainly. Again, Hanno's manner grew cheerful. I've thought how to prove my skills to you. In a short time. You realize the need to embark soon, don't you? Preferably at the start of sailing season. Because of Carthage? Hanno nodded. This new war in Sicily will engage her whole attention for a while. Agathocles of Syracuse is a harder enemy than the Carthaginian Suffetes have taken the trouble to discover. I wouldn't be surprised if he carries the fight to their shores. Pythias stared. How can you be so sure? I was lately there, and I've learned to pay attention. In Carthage, too. You're aware she discourages all foreign traffic beyond the pillars of Heracles, often by methods that would be called piracy, were it the work of a private party. Well, the Suffetes now speak of an out-and-out blockade. If they win this war, or at least fight it to a draw, I suspect they'll lack the resources for some time afterward. But eventually they'll do it. Your expedition will take a pair of years at least, likelier three, very possibly more. The earlier you set forth, the earlier you'll come home, if you do, and not run into a Carthaginian patrol. What a shame after an odyssey like that to end at the bottom of the sea or on an auction block. We'll have an escort of warships. Hanno shook his head. Oh, no. Anything less than a pentaconter would be useless, and that long hull would never survive the North Atlantic. My friend, you haven't seen waves or storms till you've been yonder. Also, how do you carry food and water for all those rowers? They burn it like wildfire, you know, and resupplying will be chancy at best. My namesake could explore the African coasts in galleys, but he was soft-bound. You'll need sail. Let me counsel you on what ships to buy. You claim a great many proficiencies, Pythias murmured. I have been through a great many schools, Hanno replied. They talked onward for an hour, and agreed to meet again on the following day. Pythias escorted his visitor out. They stopped for a moment at the front door. The house stood high on a ridge above the bay. Eastward, beyond city walls, hills glowed with sunset. The streets of the old Greek colony had become rivers of shadow. Voices, footfalls, wheels were muted. The air rested in chilly peace. Westward, the sun cast a bridge across the waters. Masts in the harbor stood stark against it. Gulls cruising overhead caught the light on their wings, gold beneath blue. A lovely sight, Pythias said low. This coast must be the most beautiful in the world. Hanno parted his lips as if to tell about others he had seen, closed them, said finally, Let us try to bring you back here, then. It won't be easy. 2. Three vessels fared by moonlight. Their masters dared not put in at Gadara or any part of Tartessus, Carthaginian territory, and kept the sea after dark. The crews muttered, but night sailing was not unheard of on familiar lanes, and to be out in the very ocean was a strangeness overwhelming all else. The craft were alike, so they could more readily travel in convoy. Each was a merchantman, though her principal cargo was well-armed men and their supplies. Narrower in the beam than most of its kind, the black hull swept some 100 feet from the high stern, where the twin steering oars were, and a swan's head ornament reared, to the cutwater at the prow. A mast amidships carried a large square sail and a triangular topsail. Forward of it stood a small deckhouse, aft of it lay 2 rowboats, for towing her at need, or saving lives in the worst need. She could get perhaps 80 degrees off the wind, slowly and awkwardly, Nimbler rigs existed, but drew less well. Tonight, with a favoring breeze, she made about 5 knots. Hannah came forth. The cabin, which the officers shared, was confining for a person of his habits. Often he slept on deck, together with such of the crew as found the spaces below too cramped and smelly. Several of them rested blanket-wrapped on straw ticks along the bulwarks. Moonlight turned planks hoar, cross-barred with long, unrestful shadows. Air blew cold, and Hanno drew his clamus close about him. The wind lulled above foosh of waves, creak of timbers and tackle. The ship rocked gently, making muscles flex in a dance with her. A figure stood at the starboard rail, near the forward lookout. Hanno recognized Pythia's profile against Quicksilver Moonglade, and went to join him. "Rejoice," he greeted. "You can't sleep either?" "I hope to make observations," the Greek replied. "Nights this clear will be few for us, won't they?" Hanno looked outward. Brightness rippled, sheened, sparked over the water. Foam swirled ghostly. Lanterns hung from the yard, scarcely touched his vision, though he saw their counterparts glimmer and sway on the companion ships. Across a distance, hard to gauge in this moving mingling of light and night, a vague mass lifted. Iberia. "We've been lucky thus far in the weather," Hanno said. He gestured at the goniometer in Pythia's hand. "But is that thing of any use here? It would be much more accurate ashore. If only we could... Well, doubtless I'll find better opportunities later. The bears will be higher in the sky." Hanno glanced at those constellations. They had dimmed as the moon climbed. "What are you trying to measure?" "I want to locate the north celestial pole more exactly than has hitherto been done," Pythias pointed. "Do you see how the two brightest stars in the Lesser Bear, with the first star in the tail, form 3 corners of a quadrangle? The pole is the fourth, or so they say." "I know, I am your navigator." "I beg your pardon, I forgot for a moment, too absorbed." Pythias chuckled ruefully, then grew eager. "If this rule of thumb can be refined, you appreciate what a help that will give seamen. Still more will it mean to geographers and cosmographers. Since the gods have not seen fit to place a star just at the pole, or even especially close, we must make do as best we are able." "There have been such stars in the past," Hanno said. "There will be again in the future." "What?" Pythia stared at him through the phantom radiance. "Do you mean the heavens change?" "Over centuries?" Hanno's hand made a chopping motion. "Forget it. Like you, I spoke without thinking. I don't expect you to believe me. Call it a sailor's tall tale." Pythias stroked his chin. "As a matter of fact," he said, low and slow, "a correspondent of mine in Alexandria, at its great library, has mentioned that ancient records give certain intimations. It requires deeper study. But you, Hanno..." The Phoenician formed a disarming grin. "Perhaps I make lucky guesses once in a while. You are unique in several respects. You've actually told me very little about yourself. Is Hanno the name you were born with?"
"It serves."
"You seem without home, family, ties of any kind." Impulsively, "I hate to think of you as lonely and defenseless." "Thank you, but I need no sympathy." Hanno mildened his manner. "You judge me by yourself. Are you already homesick?" "Not really. Not on this quest that I've dreamt of for years." The Greek paused. "But I do have roots, wife, children. My oldest son is married. He should have grandchildren for me when I return." With a smile, "My oldest daughter is now marriageable. I left arrangements for her in my brother's hands, with my wife's advice and consent. Yes, my little Danae, too. She may well have a little one of her own by that time." He shook himself as if the wind had touched him with cold. "It won't do to yearn. We'll be long gone at best." Hanno shrugged. "And meanwhile, I've found barbarian women are usually easy." Pythias regarded him for a silent spell and said nothing about youths already available. Whatever Hanno's tastes might be, He didn't expect the Phoenician would become intimate with any member of the expedition. Behind that genial front of his, how much humanity was in him? 3. All at once, like a blow to the belly, there the Keltoi were. A dozen tall warriors sprang from the forest and started across the grassy slope to the beach. A score, 100, 200 or worse. More swarmed onto the twin headlands, sheltering the cove where the ships had anchored. Mariners yelled, dropped their work of preparing camp, snatched for their weapons, milled about. Soldiers among them, hoplites and peltasts, most still armored, pushed through the chaos to take formation. Helmets, breastplates, shields, swords, pike heads shimmered dully in a thin rain. Hanno ran to their captain, Demetrios, caught him by the wrist and snapped, "Don't initiate hostilities. They'd love to take our heads home. Battle trophies." The hard visage fleered. "Do you suppose if we stay peaceful they'll embrace us?" "That depends." Hanno squinted into the dimness before him. The hidden sun at his back had to be near the horizon. Trees made a gray wall behind the oncoming attackers. War cries went saw-edged over the boom of surf outside the little bay, echoed from cliff to cliff, sent gulls shrieking aloft. "Someone spied us, maybe days ago, sent word to his fellow clansmen. They followed our course with the woods for a screen. They expected we'd camp at one of the places where the Carthaginians do. We'd see the burnt wood, rubbish, traces, and head in." He was thinking aloud. "Why didn't they wait till we were asleep except for our sentries? They must be afraid of the dark. This can't be their country. And so, hold fast. Give me... I should have a peeled wand or a green bough, but this may suffice." Hanno turned about and tugged at the standard. Its bearer clung and cursed him. "Make him give me this, Demetrios," Hanno demanded. The mercenary leader hesitated an instant before he ordered, "Let go, Cleanthes." "Good. Now, blow trumpets, bang on shields, raise all the noise you can, but stay where you are." The emblem aloft, Hanno advanced. He moved slowly, gravely, staff in right hand, naked sword in left. At his rear, brass brayed and iron thundered. The Carthaginians had cleared away high growth as far as the spring where they got water, a distance of about an Athenian stadium. New brush sprang up to hinder passage and make it noisy. Thus total surprise was impossible, and the Gauls were not yet in that headlong dash which civilized men dreaded. They trotted forward as individuals or small groups, disorderly and deadly. They were big, fair-complexioned men. Most flaunted long mustaches. None had shaved lately. Those that did not braid their hair had treated it with a material that reddened it and stiffened it into spikes. Paint and tattoos adorned bodies sometimes naked, oftener wrapped in a dyed woolen kilt, a sort of primitive himation, or attired in breeches and perhaps a tunic of gaudy hues. Their weapons were long swords, spears, dirks. Some bore round shields, a few had helmets. One huge man at the forefront of the roughly semicircular van wore a gilt helmet that flared out in horns. A bronze torque circled his throat, gold helices his arms. The warriors to his right and left were almost as flamboyant. He must be the chief. Hanno moved toward him. The racket from among the Greeks was giving the barbarians pause, puzzling them. They slowed, looked around, damped their shouts, and muttered to each other. Watching, Pythias saw Hanno meet their leader. He heard horns blow, voices ring. Men sped about, carrying a word he could not understand. The Gauls grumbled piecemeal to a halt, withdrew a ways, squatted down or leaned on their spears, waited. The drizzle thickened, daylight faded, and he saw only shadows yonder. An hour dragged itself into dusk. Fires blossomed under the forest. Hanno returned. He walked like another shadow past Demetrios' pickets, between the hushed and huddled sailors, to find Pythias near the boats, not to flee, but because there the water cast off enough light to ease the wet gloom a little. "We're safe," Hanno declared. Breath gusted out of Pythias. "But we've a busy night ahead of us," Hanno went on. "Kindle fires, pitch tents, get the best of the wretched food we have and cook it as well as possible. Not that our visitors will notice the quality. It's quantity that counts with them." Pythias peered, striving to read the half-seen face.
"What's happened?"
he asked unevenly. "What have you done?" Hanno's tone stayed cool, with a hint of hidden laughter. "You know, I've acquired enough Celtic language to get by, and a fair acquaintance with their customs and beliefs. Those aren't too different from several other wild races. I can guess my way past any gaps in my knowledge. I went out to them in the style of a herald which made my person sacred, and talked with their chief. He's not a bad fellow, as such people go. I've known worse monsters in power among Hellenes, Persians, Phoenicians, Egyptians. No matter.
What did they want?
To overcome us before we could escape, of course. Take our boats, capture our ships, plunder them. The fact alone showed this isn't likely their native country. Carthaginians have treaties with natives. True, these might have denounced the agreement for some childish reason. However, then they'd have attacked after dark. They brag about their fearlessness, but when it's a question of booty more than glory, they wouldn't care to take unnecessary casualties or risk our being able to stand them off while most of us got away to the ships. Nevertheless, they came at us as soon as we were ashore, so they must be afraid of the dark hereabouts, ghosts and gods of the lately slain, not yet appeased. I played on that, among other things. Who are they? Pictinies from the east, intending to settle these parts. Hanno began pacing to and fro before the eyes of Pythias. Sand scrunched soddenly underfoot. Not much like those tame and half-tame tribes in your Massalian hinterland, but not entirely alien to them either. They have more respect for skills, for learning, than I've generally found your ordinary Greek does. Their ornament, all their workmanship, is beautiful. Not only a herald, but a poet, any wise person is sacred. I proved myself a magician, what they call a druid, by various sleight-of-hand tricks and occultistic nonsense. I threatened, oh, very delicately, to lay a satire on them if they offended me. First, I'd convinced them I was a poet, by a rough plagiarism of lines from Homer. I'll have to work on that. I've promised them war.
You have what?
Hanno's laugh rang aloud. Ready the camp, I say. Prepare the feast. Tell Demetrios's men there to be an honor guard. You'll have guests at dawn, and I dare say the festivities will brawl on through the whole day. You'll be expected to give pretty lavish gifts, but that's all right. We have ample trade goods along, and honor will require you receive several-fold the value in stuff we can better use. Also, we now have safe conduct for a considerable distance north. He paused. Sea and land sighed around them. Oh, and if we get decent weather tomorrow night, do carry on your star observations, Pythias. That will impress them no end.
And it's a part of what we're journeying for, whispered the other man. What you've saved.
4. Behind lay the Dumnonian tin mines, and the harbor to which no Carthaginians would come while the war lasted, and the three ships. Lycius kept a guard on them and saw to their careening and refitting. Demetrios organized overland explorations of the west and south coasts, the interior and north of Britannia, Pythias claimed for himself. He came with Hanno and a small military escort out of the hills onto a rolling plain where, here and there, wilderness yielded to ploughland and pasture. A gigantic mound inside a fosse and earthworks dominated it. The chalky crater hollowed on top held armed men and their lodgings. Its commander received the travelers hospitably, once he was sure of their intentions. Folk were always eager for word from outside. Most barbarians had pathetically narrow horizons. Talk went haltingly by way of Hanno and the Dumnonian who had accompanied the party this far. Now he wanted to go home. A man by some such name as Sigovax offered to replace him and lead the guests to a great wonder nearby. Autumn was in the wind, chill and loud. Leaves were turning yellow, brown, russet, and beginning to fly away. A trail went on to an upland where trees were few. Cloud shadows and pale sunlight sickled across immensities of sallow grass. Sheep flocks afar were lost in loneliness. The Greeks marched briskly, leading the pack ponies they had gotten in Dumnonia, They would not return to the hill fort, but push on. One winter was scant time to range this land. Come spring, Pythias must be back with his ships. The sight waxed slowly before him. At first it seemed little, and he supposed people made much of it only because they knew nothing better. As he neared, the sense of its mass grew and grew. Within a time-worn earthen rampart loomed a triple ring of standing stones, perhaps 70 cubits wide, the tallest of them well-nigh 3 man-heights, slabs almost as huge joining them on top, gray, lichenous, weathered, powerful beyond his understanding. "What is this?" he whispered. "You've seen megalithic works in the south, haven't you?" Hanno's voice was less calm than his words, hushed beneath the wind. "Yes, but nothing like—" "Ask!" Hanno turned to Sigobax, Celtic lilted between them. "He says giants built it in the morning of the world," Hanno told Pythias. "Then his people are as ignorant as we," the Greek said low. "We'll camp here, overnight at least. Maybe we can learn something." It was more a prayer than a hope. Throughout the rest of the day he devoted himself to his eyes and his instruments. Hanno could give scant help, and Sigovax hardly any information. Once Pythias spent a long time finding the exact center of the complex and sighting from there. "I think," he said as he pointed, "that yonder stone outside, the sun will be seen to rise over it on Midsummer's Day. But I cannot be sure, and we cannot wait to find out, can we?" Night approached. The soldiers, who had snatched the chance to idle, started a fire, cooked food, made ready. Their talk and occasional laughter rattled meaningless. They had no reason to fear attack by mortal men, nor to wonder what ghosts might linger here. The weather had cleared, and after full darkness Pythias left the camp to observe, which he did at every opportunity. Hanno came along, bearing a wax tablet and stylus to record the measurements. He had the Phoenician trick of writing without light. Pythias could use ridges and grooves to read instruments by his fingertips, measurements less close than he wished, but preferable to none at all. When a stone had blocked view of flames, they were alone in the ring with the sky. Tightened blacknesses walled them in. Stars flickered between, as if trapped. Overhead curved the galaxy, a river of mist across which winged the swan. The lyre hung silent. The dragon coiled halfway around a pole strangely high in heaven. Cold deepened with the hours. The vast wheel turned. Frost formed hoar on the stones. "Hadn't we better get some sleep?" Hanno asked at last. "I'm forgetting what warmth feels like." "I suppose so," Pythias' answer dragged. "I've learned as much as I can." Abruptly, harshly, "It isn't enough. It never will be. Our lives are 1,000,000 years too short." 5. After the long voyage north, past land that grew ever more rugged, ever more girded with holms and reefs, the coast finally bent eastward. These were waters as rough as the ground on which their surf crashed. The ship stood well out and cast anchor at sunset. It was better to huddle fireless than dare those unknown approaches. On the fourth day there appeared above haze the red and yellow heights of an island. Pythias decided to pass between it and the main shore. His vessels battled their way on until dark. Men saw no dawn, for air had thickened further. Aft of them a whiteness towered from edge to unseen edge of the world. They had a light breeze and visibility of about 12 Athenian stadia, so they hoisted dripping sails. The sheer island began to fall behind them, and ahead, to starboard, they spied a murk that ought to be a lesser one. Noise of breakers loudened, an undergroundish thunder. Then the white wall rolled over them, and they were blind. The breeze died, and they lay helpless. Never had they known or heard of a fog such as this. A man amidships saw neither bow nor stern. Vision lost itself in smothering, eddying gray. Over the side he could barely make out turbulence streaked with foam.
Water settled on cordage and fell off in a wicked little rain. The deck sheened with it. Wetness weighted hair, clothes, breath, while cold gnawed inward to the bone, as if he were already drowning. The formlessness was full of noise. Seas grew heavier, timbers groaned, the hull swayed crazily. Billows rushed and grumbled, surf roared. Horns hooted, crew wailed themselves hoarse, ship called desperately to unseen ship. Pythias, aft by the helm, shook his head. "What makes the waves rise when we have no wind?" he asked through the tumult. The steersman gripped his useless tiller and shuddered. "Things out of the deeps!" he rasped. "Or the gods of these waters, angry that we trouble them?" "Launch the boats," Hanno advised Pythias. "They'll give some warning if we're about to drift onto a rock, and maybe they can pull us clear." The steersman bared teeth. "Oh, no, you don't!" he cried. "You'll not send men down to the demon beasts. They won't go." "I won't send them," Hanno retorted. "I'll lead them." "Or I," Pythias said. It became the Phoenician who shook his head. "We can't risk you. Who else could have brought us this far, or can bring us home? Without you, we're all dead. Come, help me put spirit into the crew." He got his men, because Pythias' calm words damped the terror in them. They unlashed a boat, dragged it to the side, shoved it over a rail when the deck canted and white-maned waves galloped just beneath. Hanno sprang down, braced calves between two thwarts, took an oar a sailor handed him, fended off while his rowers followed one by one. They fought free at the end of a tow-line, and the next boat came after. "I do hope the other skippers," began Hanno. A dash of brine choked off what nobody heard anyhow. The ship was gone into wet smoke. The boat climbed a comber that was like a moving hillside, hovered on the crest, plunged into a trough where men looked up the heights of water around them. Noise rolled empty of direction. Hanno, at the rudder, could only try to keep the hawser unfouled behind him. "Stroke!" he bawled. "Stroke! Stroke! Stroke!" Men gasped at oars and bailing buckets. The sea lapped around their ankles. A monstrous grip seized them. They whirled. A cataract leaped out of the fog. It burst over their heads. When they could see again, the ship was upon them. The boat smashed into her hull. The water grounded against the strakes. Wood broke, tore free of nails, shrieked. The boat fell asunder. Pythias beheld it. A man flailed arms and legs. The sea dashed him at the ship. His skull split open. Brains, blood, body went under. "Lines out!" Pythias shouted. He himself didn't stop to uncoil any from a bollard. He drew his knife and slashed a sheet free of the slack mainsail. When he cast the end overboard, it disappeared in fog and foam. None of the swimmers he glimpsed, lost, glimpsed again, had noticed it. He signaled for another length. The cut sheet still cleated, and in his left hand he slid over the rail. Feet planted on the hull, arms straining to hold the cordage taut and himself in place, he leaned straight out. With his right hand he swung the second line like a whip. Now he was visible to those he would save, except when the vessel rose onto that side and a wave fountained across him. A man swung past. Pythias flicked the loose line at his face. The man caught it. Sailors on deck hauled him aboard. The third whom Pythias rescued was Hanno, clinging to an oar. After that his strength was spent. He got back with the help of two mariners and fell in a heap beside the Phoenician. No others attempted his feat, but no more waifs came to sight in the rage around. Hanno stirred. "To the cabin, you and me and these two," he said through chattering teeth, "else the cold will kill us. We wouldn't have lived 10 minutes in that water." In the shelter, men stripped, toweled till blood awoke to stinging life, pulled blankets tightly about themselves. "You were magnificent, my friend," Hanno said. "I wouldn't have supposed you, a scholar, tough but a scholar, could do it." "Nor would I have." Exhaustion flattened Pythias' voice. "You saved us few from the consequences of my folly." "No folly. Who could have foreseen the sea in windless air would go so wild so fast?" "What might have done it?" "Demons," mumbled a sailor, No, Pythias replied. It must have been a trick of these enormous Atlantic tides thrusting through a strait cluttered with isles and reefs. Hanno mustered a chuckle. Still the philosopher, you. We've a boat left, Pythias said, and our luck may turn. Beseech your gods if you like, boys. He lay down on his pallet. I am going to sleep. 6. The ship survived, though one scraped a rock and opened seams. When fog had lifted and waters somewhat calmed, rowers pulled the three to the high island. They found a safe anchorage with a sloping strand where, at low water, they could work to repair damage. Several families lived nearby, unshorn, skin-clad fishers who kept a few animals and scratched in tiny gardens. Their dwellings were dry-laid stones and turf roofs above pits. At first they fled and watched from afar. Pythias ordered goods set out, and they timidly returned to collect these. Thereafter the Greeks were their house guests. That proved fortunate. A gale came from the west. The ships got barely adequate protection from the bluffs around the east side inlet, but everywhere else the storm ramped unchecked for days and nights. Men could not stand against it. Indoors they must struggle to speak and hear through the racket. Breakers higher than city battlements hurled themselves onto the western cliffs. Stones weighing tons broke from their beds in what had been the shallows. Earth trembled. The air was a torrent of spume, whose salt flayed faces and blinded eyes. It was as if the world had toppled into primordial chaos. Pythias, Hanno, and their companions, hunched crowded together on dried seaweed strewn over a dirt floor in a cave of gloom. Coals glowed faint red on the hearthstone. Smoke drifted acrid through the chill. Pythias was another shadow, his words a whisper amidst the violence. The fog, and now this. Here is neither sea nor land nor air. They have all become one, a thing like a sea lung. Farther north can only be the great ice. I think we are near the border of life's kingdom. They saw his head lift. But we have not come to the end of our search. 7. Eastward over sea, 4 days sail from the northern tip of Britannia, the explorers found another land. It rose sharply out of the water, but homes protected a great bay. On an arm of this dwelt folk who received newcomers kindly. They were not Keltoi, being even more tall and fair. Their language was kin to a Germanic tongue, which Hanno had gotten a little of on an earlier wandering. He could soon make himself understood. Their iron tools and weapons, arts and way of life, did bear a Celtic mark. However, their spirits seemed different, more sober, less possessed by the unearthly. The Greeks meant to abide a short while, inquire about those realms that were their goal, take on fresh supplies, and proceed. But their stay lengthened. Toil, danger, loss had worn them down. Here they found hospitality and admiration. As they gained words, they won full comradeship, shared in undertakings, swapped thoughts and recollections and songs, sported, made merry. The women were welcoming. Nobody urged Pythias to order anchors up or asked why he did not. The guests were no parasites. They brought wonderful gifts. On a ship of theirs they carried men who knew only longboats fashioned of planks stitched together, driven by paddles. Those men learned more about their own waters and communities elsewhere than they had dreamed they might. Trade followed, and visits to and fro for the first time ever. Hunting was excellent in the hinterland, and the soldiers fetched plenty of meat home. The presence of the Greeks, their revelation of an outside world, gave new sparkle to life. They felt themselves taken into brotherhood. This was the country its people named Thule. Midsummer came, with the light nights. Hanno and Alas went to gather berries. Alone, under the sweetnesses of birch trees, they made love. The long day tired her, and after they returned to her father's house, she fell happily asleep. He could not. He lay for an hour on their bed of hides, feeling her warm against him, hearing her and her family breathe, himself inhaling the fragrance and pungency of the cows stalled at the far end of the single long room. A banked fire sometimes let slip a flamelet, but what made soft dusk was the sky beyond the wickerwork door.
Finally he rose, pulled his tunic back over his head, and stole forth. Above him reached utter clarity, a hue that raised memories of white roses. No more than half a dozen stars could shine through it, a tremble, barely seeable. Air rested cool, so quiet that he heard water lap on the bay shore. Dew gleamed on ground that slanted down to the broad argency of it. Inland, the terrain climbed toward mountains whose ridges lifted blue-gray into heaven. He left the village. Its houses nestled together, a double row that ended at a great barn where grain was threshed in this rainy climate, and which would serve as a fortress in case of attack. Beyond were paddocks, beehives, small fields goldening toward harvest. He drifted from them beachward. When he came to grass, he wiped off his bare feet the muck that free-running pigs and chickens had left in the lane. The moisture caressed him. Farther on, he reached shingle, rocks cold and hard, but worn smooth. The tide was ebbing, that mighty pulse which the Mediterranean Sea scarcely felt, and kelp sprawled along the strand. It gave off odors of salt, depths, mysteries. Some distance onward, a man stood looking aloft. Brass gleamed as he pointed his instrument. Hanno approached. "You too?" he murmured. Pythias started, turned about, and replied mechanically, "Rejoice!" In the luminous twilight it was clear how he must force a smile. "Not easy to sleep under these conditions," Hanno ventured. The natives themselves didn't much. Pythias nodded. "I hate to miss a minute of the loveliness. Poor for astronomy, though. By day I've been gathering data that will yield a better value for the obliquity of the ecliptic." "You should have ample by now. We're past the solstice." Pythias glanced away. "And you sound right defensive," Hanno pursued. "Why do we linger here?" Pythias bit his lip. "We've a wealth of discoveries still to make. It's like a whole new world." Hanno's voice crackled, "like the land of the lotus eaters." Pythias lifted his quadrant as if it were a shield. "No, no, these are real people. They labor and have children and grow old and die, the same as us." Hanno regarded him. The waters whispered. Finally, the Phoenician said, "It's Vanna, isn't it?" Pythias stood mute. "Many of these girls are beautiful," Hanno went on. "Height, slenderness, skin that the summer sun kisses tawny, eyes like the sky around that sun, and those blonde manes. Oh, yes. And the one who's with you, she's the bonniest of the lot." "It's more than that," Pythias said. "She's free, unlettered, unaware, but quick and eager to learn, proud, fearless. We cage our wives, we Greeks. I never thought of it till lately, but is it not our doing that the poor creatures turn so dull that we're apt to seek sweethearts male? Or whores? Vanna is as mettlesome as the liveliest Hetaira, but she's not for sale, Hanno. She honestly loves me. A few days ago we decided she must be carrying my child. She came to my arms weeping and laughing. She's a dear person, true, but she's a barbarian. That can be changed." Hanno shook his head. "Don't play tricks on yourself, my friend. It's not like you. Do you daydream about taking her along when we leave? If she survived the voyage, she'd wither and die in Massalia, like an uprooted wildflower. What could she make herself into? What sort of life could you give her? You're too late, both of you." Again Pythias stood mute. "Nor can you settle here," Hanno told him. "Only think, you, a civilized man, a philosopher, crammed cheek by jowl with other human bodies and cattle into a wretched wattle and daub hut. No books, no correspondence, no discourse, no sculptures, no temples, no traditions of yours, nothing of all that's gone to form your soul. She'll age fast, your lady. Her teeth will go, and her dugs will sag, and you'll loathe her because she was the bait that trapped you. Think, I say, think!" Pythias' free hand knotted into a fist and smote his thigh over and over. "But what can I do? Leave! She'll have no trouble getting a husband who'll raise the child.
Her father's well off by their standards. She's proven herself fertile, and every child is precious, as many of them as they lose. Hoist sail and go. We came in search of the Amber Island, remember? Or if it's a myth, then we want to find whatever the reality is. We have these eastern shores and seas to learn a little about. We mean to return to Britannia and finish circumnavigating it, determine its size and shape, for it's important to Europe in a way that Thule can't be for centuries, and then come home to your people, city, wife, children, grandchildren. Do your duty, man. You speak harshly. Yes, I respect you that much, Pythias. The Greek looked from side to side, to the mountains athwart that sky which hid the stars in its light, down over woodlands and meadows, out across the shining bay toward unseen ocean. Yes, he said at last, you're right. We should have departed long ago. We shall. I'm a graybeard fool. Hanno smiled. No, simply a man. She brought a springtime you thought you'd lost back into your heart. How often I've seen it happen. Has it to you? Hanno laid a hand on his friend's shoulder. Come, he said. Let's go back and try to sleep. We've work ahead of us. 8. Weary, battered, faded, and triumphant, three ships neared Massalia Harbor. It was a crisp autumn day. The water danced and glittered as if diamond were strewn upon sapphire, but wind was light and bottoms were foul. They moved slowly. Pythias beckoned Hanno to him. "Stand with me here on the foredeck," he requested, "for it may be the last quiet talk we shall ever have." The Phoenician joined him in the bows. Pythias was being his own lookout in this final hour of his voyage. "You can certainly expect a busy time," Hanno agreed. "Everybody and his third cousin will want to meet you, question you, hear you lecture, send you letters, demand a copy of your book, and insist you write it yesterday." Pythias' lips quirked upward. "You'll always have a jape, won't you?" They stood for a bit, watching. Now, as the season of the mariners drew to a close, the waves, how small and gentle in this refuge from the Atlantic, were beswarmed with vessels, rowboats, lighters, tarry fishers, tubby coastwise merchantmen, a big grain ship from Egypt, a gilt-trimmed barge, two lean warcraft spider-walking on oars, all sought passage. Shouts and oaths volleyed, sails boomed, yard-arms slatted, thole-pins creaked. The city shone ahead, a blue-shadowed, white intricacy overspilling its walls. Smoke blew in tatters from red-tile roofs. Farmsteads and villas nestled amidst brown stubble fields, pastures still green, darkling pines and yellowing orchards beyond. At the back of those hills, a higher range lifted dun. Gulls dipped and soared, mewing in their hundreds, like a snowstorm of the north. "You will not change your mind, Hanno?" Pythias asked. The other turned grim. "I cannot. I'll stay till I collect my pay, and then be off." "Why, I don't understand, and you won't explain." "It's best. I tell you, a man of your abilities has a brilliant future here, boundless, and not as a metic. With the influence I'll have, I can get you Massaliot citizenship, Hanno." "I know. You've said this before." "Thank you, but no." Pythias touched the Phoenician's hand, which grasped the rail hard. "Are you afraid people will hold your origin against you?" "They won't, I promise. We're above that. We're a cosmopolis." "I am everywhere an alien." Pythias sighed. "Never have you opened your soul to me as I have to you. And even so, I have never felt so close to anyone else. Not even—" He broke off, and both turned their glances aside. Hanno took on his cool tone again. He smiled. "We've been through tremendous things together, good and bad, terrible and tedious, frolicsome and frightening, delightful and deadly. That does forge bonds. And yet you will sever them. So easily?" Pythias wondered. "You will merely bid me farewell?" In a single instant, before Hanno summoned laughter back to himself, something tore apart, and the Greek looked into a pain that bewildered him.
What else is life but always bidding farewell?
Chapter 2 The Peaches of Forever. To Yun Ding Guo, sub-prefect of the Tumbling Brook District, came an inspector from Chang'an, on an errand for the very emperor. A courier arrived beforehand, giving the household time to prepare a suitable welcome. Next noontide the party appeared, first a dust cloud on the eastern road, then a troop of mounted men, servants, and soldiers, attendant on a carriage drawn by four white horses. Pennons aloft, metal aflash, they made a brave sight. Yun Ding Guo appreciated it the more against the serenity of the landscape. From his hilltop compound the view swept down to Millstone Village, earthen walls, roofs of tile or thatch, huddled together along lanes where pigs and peasants fared, but not unsightly, an outgrowth, a part of the yellow-brown loess soil from which men drew their lives. Beyond reached the land. This was early summer, barley and millet intensely green on their terraces, dotted with blue-clad human forms at work. Farmhouses nestled tiny, strewn across distances. Orchards here and there were done flowering, but fruit was set and leaves full of sunlight. Willows along irrigation canals shivered pale beneath a breeze that smelled warmly of growth. Pine and cypress on farther ridges gave dark dignity. Right and left were heights used for pasture, whose contours stood bold out of shadow. West of the village, those hills steepened rapidly, and forest covered much of them. The journey remained long and ever more difficult to yonder frontier, to the realms of the Tibetans and Mongols and other barbarians, but already here civilization began thinning out, and one treasured it as perhaps no one quite could in its heartland. Yun Ding Guo murmured, "Beautiful are the procession of seasons bequeathed us by the gods, and the procession of ways and rites bequeathed us by the ancestors." But broke the old poem off and went back through the gate. Ordinarily he would have continued to his house and waited inside. To receive an imperial envoy, he placed himself and his sons, robed in their best, on the porch. Servants flanked the direct way to it across the outer court. Elsewhere, shrubs made a kind of maze conducting attention to a goldfish pond. Women, children, and menial workers were tucked away in other buildings of the compound. Stamp, rattle, and clang announced the advent. An equerry did so more formally, dismounting and entering, to be met halfway by the sub-prefect's chamberlain. They exchanged bows and necessary words. Thereafter the inspector appeared. The servants prostrated themselves, and Yun Ding Guo gave him the reverence due from a nobleman of lesser rank. Tsai Li responded courteously. He was not of the most impressive, being a short man and rather young for one of such stature, whereas the sub-prefect was tall and gray. Even the emblems the inspector had donned upon leaving his vehicle showed signs of hard travel. However, many generations of closeness to the throne lived on in his quiet self-assurance. It was to be seen that host and guest took a quick liking to each other. Presently they could talk alone. Tsai Li had been conducted to his quarters, helped to a bath and a change of raiment. Meanwhile arrangements were made for his entourage, assistants and attendants quartered according to rank in the compound, soldiers among the villagers. Savory odors drifted about, a banquet in preparation, spices, herbs, roasting meats, fowl, suckling pig, puppy, turtle, and liquors gently warmed. Sometimes a twang of zither or chime of bell came audibly loud from the house where singers and dancing girls rehearsed. The inspector had intimated that before thus meeting local officials, he wished a confidential talk. It took place in a chamber almost bare except for two screens, fresh straw mats, armrests, a low table whereon waited wine and rice cakes from the south. Still, the room was bright and airy, its proportions pleasant. The paintings, of bamboo and of a mountain scene, and the calligraphy on the screens were exquisite. Tsai Li expressed proper admiration, sufficient to show he appreciated, not enough to require they be given him. "My lord's slave returns humble thanks," Yun Ding Guo said. I fear he will find us a somewhat poor and uncultivated lot in these remote parts. Not at all, replied Sylee. Long polished fingernails gleamed as he brought cup to lips. Indeed, here seems to be a haven of peace and order. Alas, even near the capital, bandits and malcontents are rife, while elsewhere there is actual rebellion, and doubtless the Xiong Nu beyond the wall look hungrily our way once more. Thus I must perforce have my escort of soldiers. His tone registered his scorn for that lowliest of the free classes. By the favor of heaven, no need for them arose. The astrologers had indeed found a propitious day for my departure. The presence of the soldiers may have helped, said Yan Dingwo dryly. Sylee smiled. So speaks the bluff old baron. I gather your family has provided this district with its leaders for a goodly time, since the Emperor Wu Ti appointed my honored ancestor Yang Ji after his service against the northern barbarians. Ah, those were the glorious days. Sylee breathed forth the least of sighs. We impoverished heirs of them can only strive against a rising flood of troubles. Yan Dingwo shifted on his heels, cleared his throat, looked straight across the table, and said, My lord is surely at the forefront in that effort, having made such a long and arduous journey. In what may we help further his righteous purposes? Largely, I require information, and perhaps a guide. Word has reached the capital of a sage, a veritable holy man in your domain. Yan Dingwo blinked. What? Traveler's tales. But we have questioned several such men at length, and the stories agree. He preaches the Tao, and his virtue appears to have brought him great longevity. Sylee hesitated. Actual immortality? What can you tell me, Sir Subprefect? Oh, Yan Dingwo scowled. I understand. The person who names himself Dushan. You are skeptical, then? He does not fit my idea of a holy man, Sir Inspector. Yan Dingwo growled. We get no few who claim to be. Simple country folk are all too ready to listen, especially in unsettled times like these. Masterless wanderers, who do no useful work but beg or wheedle their way along. They claim tremendous powers. Peasants swear they have seen such a one cure the sick, exorcise demons, raise the dead, or what have you. I've looked into some cases and found no real proof of anything, except that often the drifter has availed himself of men's purses and women's bodies, convincing them that is the way before moving elsewhere. Sylee narrowed his eyes. We know about charlatans, he said. We also know about ordinary Wu, folk magicians, honest enough, but illiterate and superstitious. Indeed, their beliefs and practices have seeped into the once pure teachings of Lao Tzu. This is unfortunate. Does not the court follow instead the precepts of the great Kung Fu Tzu? Certainly. Yet wisdom and strength grow scarce, Sir Subprefect. We must seek them where they are to be found. What we have heard of this Dushan has led the one man himself to think that this will be a desirable voice among the imperial counselors. Yan Dingwo stared down into his cup, as if to seek a comforting revelation therein. It is not for the likes of me to question the Son of Heaven, he said at length, and I dare say that fellow can do no serious harm. He laughed. Perhaps his advice will prove no worse than some. Sylee regarded him for a silent while before murmuring, Do you imply, Sir Subprefect, that the Emperor has occasionally been misled in the past? Yan Dingwo paled a little, then flushed and almost snapped. I speak no disrespectful word, Sir Mandarin. Of course not. Understood, said Sylee smoothly, although between us the implication is quite correct. Yan Dingwo gave him a startled stare. Sylee's tone grew earnest. Please consider. It is now 10 years since glorious Wang Mang received the mandate of heaven. He has decreed many reforms, and sought in every way to better the lot of his people. Yet unrest waxes. So, be it said, due poverty at home and barbarian arrogance abroad. He left unspoken, there are those, ever more of them, who declare that the Xin is not a new dynasty at all, but only a usurpation, a product of palace intrigue, and the time is overpast to restore the Han to that power which is rightfully theirs. Clearly, better counsel is much needed. Intelligence and virtue often dwell beneath a lowly roof.
The situation must be desperate if you were sent this far to track down a mere rumor, Yan Dingbo blurted. He made haste to add, Of course, we are honored and delighted by your exalted presence, my lord.
You are most gracious, Sir Subprefect. Sai Li's voice sharpened. But what can you tell me about Dushan?
Yan Dingbo looked away, frowned, tugged his beard, and spoke slowly. I cannot in honesty call him a rogue. I investigate everything questionable that I hear of, and have no report of him defrauding anyone or doing any other evil. It is only, he is not my idea of a holy man.
The seekers of the Tao are apt to be, somewhat eccentric.
I know.
Still, but let me tell you. He appeared among us 5 years ago, having passed through communities to the north and east, sojourning a while in some. With him traveled a single disciple, a young man of the farmer class. Since then he has acquired two more, and declined others, for he has settled down in a cave 3 or 4 hours' walk from here, in the forest upland by a waterfall. There he meditates, or so he claims. I have gone there, and the cave has been turned into a rather comfortable little abode, not luxurious, but no hardship to inhabit. The disciples have made themselves a hut nearby. They cultivate a bit of grain, catch a few fish, gather nuts and berries and roots. Folk bring other things as gifts, including money. They make the walk in order to hear whatever words he cares to give them, unburden themselves of their woes. He has a sympathetic ear, and receive his blessing, or simply spend a while in his silent presence. From time to time he comes down here for a day or two. Then it is the same, except that he drinks and eats well at our one inn and disports himself in our one joy-house. I hear he is a mighty lover. Well, I have not heard of him seducing any man's wife or daughter. Nevertheless, his conduct scarcely seems pious to me, nor do such preachments of his as I have heard make much sense. The Tao is not expressible in words. I know. Just the same, well, just the same. And as for making love, I have heard those learned in the Tao state that by so doing, especially if he prolongs the act as much as possible, a man comes nearer balancing his yang with the yin. At least this is one school of thought. Others disagree, I am told. But we can hardly expect conventional respectability of a person whose goal in life is enlightenment.
Yan Dingwo achieved a sour smile.
My lord is more tolerant than me, it seems.
No, I merely thought I should seek to prepare myself before setting out, that I might hope to understand whatever I may find.
Sai Li paused. What of Dushan's earlier life? How much truth is in his claim to great age? I hear he has the aspect of a young man.
He does, together with the vigor and all else. Should a sage not be rather of reverend appearance?
Yan Dingwo drew breath.
Well, but I have made inquiries about those claims of his. Not that he asserts them loudly. In fact, he never mentions the matter unless he must for some reason, as to explain how long-dead Zhou Peng could have been his teacher. But neither has he tried to cover his tracks. I have been able to question people and to visit a few sites myself when business has taken me in those directions. Please tell me what you have ascertained, that I may compare my own information.
Well, it is evidently true. He was born more than 100 years ago. That was in the Three Great Rocks district, and his class was merely artisan. He followed his father's trade, a blacksmith, married, had children, nothing unusual aside from his not growing old in body. That did gradually make him a neighborhood marvel, but he does not seem to have taken much, if any, advantage of it. Instead, when his children were married off and his wife had died, He announced he would seek wisdom, the reason for his strange condition, and for all else in the world. He set forth, and was not heard of again until he became a disciple of Zhou Peng. When that old sage died in turn, Dushan fared onward, teaching and practicing the Tao as he understood it. I do not know how close that is to what Zhou Peng taught, nor do I know how long Dushan proposes to stay here. Perhaps he himself does not. I have asked him, but such people are always skilled in evading questions they do not wish to answer. Thank you. It confirms the reports given me. Now, a man of your perspicacity, Sir Subprefect, must see that such a life indicates extraordinary powers of some kind, and a deferential presence appeared in the doorway. Enter and speak, said Yan Dingwo. Tsai Li's secretary took a step into the room, bowed low, and announced, This underling begs pardon for disturbing his superiors. However, word has just come to him which may have a certain interest and perhaps urgency. The sage Dushan is on the western road bound for the village. Has my lord any commands? Well, well, murmured the sub-prefect. What an interesting coincidence. If it is a coincidence, answered Tsai Li. Yan Dingguo lifted his heavy brows. Has he foreseen my lord's arrival and purpose? It need not be a matter of occult abilities. The Tao works to bring events together in harmony. Shall I summon him here, or bid him wait upon my lord's convenience? Neither. I will go to him, much though it pains me to interrupt this fascinating conversation. At his host's look of surprise, Tsai Li added, After all, otherwise I would have sought him out in his retreat. If he is worthy of respect, let him be shown respect. With a rustle of silk and brocade, he rose from his cushion and started forth. Yan Dingguo followed. The inspector's equerry hastened to summon a decent minimum of attendants and bring them after the magnates. They went through the gate and down the hill at a suitably dignified pace. A wind had arisen. It boomed from the north, cooling the air, driving clouds before it whose shadows went like sickles across the land. Dust whirled yellow off fields and the road. A flock of crows winged past. Their cawing cut through the babble underneath. Folk had clustered at the village well. They were those whose work was not out amidst the crops. Tradesmen, artisans, their women and children, the aged and infirm. Soldiers from the envoy's escort crowded roughly in among them, curious. All were gathered about a man who had stopped at the well side. His frame, big and broad, wore the same plain blue quilted jacket and trousers as any peasant's. His feet were bare, thick with calluses. Also bare was his head. Stray black locks fluttered free below a topknot. His face was wide, rather flat-nosed, weather-beaten. He had leaned a staff against the coping and taken a small girl child onto his shoulder. Near him stood three young men, as simply garbed as himself. "Aha, little one," the man laughed and chucked the girl under the chin. "Would you have a ride on your old horsey? Shameless beggar wench." She squirmed and giggled. "Bless her, master," asked the mother. "Why, what she is, that is the blessing," replied the man. "She is still near the fountainhead of quietness to which wise men hope they may return. Not that that forbids your desiring a sweetmeat, eh, May May?" "Can childhood, then, be better than age?" quavered one whose wispy beard fell white from a head bent forward. "You would have me teach, when my poor throat is choked by the dust of my faring," responded the man genially. "No, please, first a cup or three of wine, nothing in excess, including self-denial." "Make way," cried the equerry. "Make way for the Lord Tsai Li, imperial legate from Chang'an, and for the lord of the district, Yan Dingguo." Voices halted. People scrambled aside. Frightened, the girl whimpered and reached for her mother. The man gave her to the woman and bowed, politely, if not abjectly, as the two robed forms neared him. "Here is our sage, Dushan, Sir Inspector," said the sub-prefect. Off with you, the equerry bade the commoners. This is a matter of state.
They may listen if they wish, said Cylee mildly.
Their smell should not offend my lord's nostrils, declared the equerry, and the crowd did shuffle some distance away to stand in bunches and gape.
Let us seek back to the house, Yun Ding Wu proposed. This day you receive a great honor, Dushan.
I thank my lord most profoundly, the newcomer answered, but we are shabby and unwashed and altogether unfit for your home. His voice was deep, lacking a cultivated accent, though not quite lowly-sounding either. A chuckle seemed to run within it and flicker behind his eyes.
May I take the liberty of presenting my disciples, Chi, Wei, and Ma?
The three youths abased themselves until he gave them an unobtrusive signal to rise.
They can join us. Yun Ding Wu failed to hide his distaste entirely.
Did Dushan perceive that? He addressed Cylee.
Perhaps my lord would care to state his business at once. Then we shall know whether or not pursuing it would waste his time.
The inspector smiled.
I hope not, Sir Sage, for I have already expended a great deal of that, he said.
To the baron, the secretary, and the rest who had heard and were shocked,
Dushan is right. He has certainly spared me a doubtless difficult trail to his hermitage.
Happenstance, said the man spoken of,
nor does it take supernatural insight for me to guess your errand.
Rejoice, Cylee told him. Word of you has reached the august ears of the emperor himself. He bade me seek you out and bring you to Chang'an, that the realm have the benefit of your wisdom. The disciples gasped before recovering a measure of steadiness. Dushan stayed imperturbable.
Surely the Son of Heaven has counselors beyond counting, he said.
He does, but they are insufficient. As the proverb goes, a thousand mice do not equal a single tiger. Perhaps my lord is a bit unfair to the advisers and ministers. They have huge tasks beyond my poor wits to understand.
Your modesty is commendable. It reveals your character.
Dushan shook his head.
No, I am just a fool and ignorant. How could I dare so much as see the imperial throne?
You defame yourself, said Cylee, on a slight note of impatience. None can have lived as long as you without being intelligent and without gaining experience. Moreover, you have pondered what you have observed and drawn valuable lessons from it.
Dushan smiled wryly, as though at an equal. If I have learned anything, it is that intelligence and knowledge are worth little by themselves, failing the enlightenment that goes beyond words and the world. They serve mainly to provide us with wonderful reasons for doing what we intend to do, regardless.
Yun Ding Wu could not forbear to interject, Come, come, you are no ascetic. The emperor rewards with imperial generosity those who serve him well.
Dushan's manner shifted subtly. It hinted at a schoolmaster with a pupil somewhat slow.
I have visited Chang'an in my wanderings, though of course I could not go into the palace grounds. I was in mansions. My lords, there are too many walls there. Every ward is closed off from every other, and when the drums sound from the towers at dusk, their gates are barred to all but the nobility. In the mountains one may go freely beneath the stars.
To him who walks in the way, all places should be alike, said Cylee.
Dushan inclined his head. My lord is well versed in the Book of the Way and its virtue. But as for me, I am a blunderer, half blind, who would be forever stumbling against those walls.
Cylee stiffened. I think you make excuses to avoid a duty you would find onerous. Why do you preach to the people if you care too little about them to lend your thoughts in aid of them? They cannot be aided thus.
Lo, Dushan's words nonetheless cut through the wind. Only they themselves can cope with their troubles, just as every man can only find the Tao by himself.
Cylee's voice slid quietly as a dagger.
Do you deny the Emperor's beneficence? Many emperors have come and gone. Many more shall. Dushan gestured. Behold the flying dust. Once it too lived. The Tao alone abides. You risk punishment, Sir Sage. Sudden laughter pealed. Dushan slapped his thigh. How can a head removed from its neck give counsel? He calmed as fast. My lord, I meant no disrespect. I say only that I am not fit for the task you have in mind, and unworthy of it. Take me with you, and this will soon be clear. Better that you spare the priceless time of the one man. Tsai Li sighed. Yan Ding Guo, watching the inspector, eased a bit. You rascal, Tsai Li said, rueful. You use the book. What is the line? Like water, soft and yielding, that wears away the hardest stone. Dushan bowed. Should we not say, rather, that the stream flows on to its destiny while the stupid rock stays where it was? Now Tsai Li spoke as to an equal. If you will not go, so be it. Forgive me when I report that you proved a disappointment. Dushan nearly grinned. How shrewdly you put it. He bowed to Yan Ding Guo. See, my lord, there is no reason for me to track dirt across your beautiful mats. Best my disciples and I take ourselves from your presence at once. Correct, said the sub-prefect coldly. The inspector cast him a disapproving glance, turned again to Dushan, and said in a voice slightly less than level, Yet you, Sir Sage, have lived longer than almost any other man and show no sign of age. Can you at least tell me how this is? Dushan became grave. Some might say he spoke in pity. I am forever asked that. Well, I never give a clear answer, for I am unable. Surely you know. I have said I do not, but men insist, eh? Dushan appeared to dismiss sadness. The story goes, he said, that in the garden of Shi Wang Mu, Mother of the West, grow certain peaches, and that he whom she allows to eat of these is made immortal. Tsai Li looked long at him before answering, well nigh too softly to hear. As you wish, Sir Sage. The watching people drew breath, glanced about, one by one retreated. The inspector bowed. I depart in awe. Dushan bowed likewise. Greet the emperor. He too deserves compassion. Yan Ding Guo cleared his throat, hesitated, then at a gesture followed Tsai Li out of the village, back up the hill to the manor house. Their attendants trailed after them. The common folk made reverence, bent above folded hands, and slipped away to the shelter of their homes. Dushan and his disciples stood alone by the well. The wind blustered through silence. Shadows came and went. Dushan took his staff. Come, he said. Where, master? Chi ventured. To our retreat. Afterward. For an instant, pain crossed the face of Dushan. I do not know. Elsewhere. West into the mountains, I think. Do you fear reprisal, master? Asked Wei. No, no, I trust the word of yonder lord. But it is well to be gone. This wind smells of trouble. The master can tell, said brash Ma. He must have caught that scent often in his many years. Did you indeed taste those peaches? Dushan laughed a little. I had to tell the man something. Doubtless the story will spread, and tales will arise of others who have done the same. Well, we shall be afar. He began walking. I have warned you aplenty, lads, he continued, and I will warn you again. I have no inspiration, no secrets to impart. I am the most ordinary of persons, except that somehow, for some reason, my body has stayed young. So I searched for understanding and discovered that this is the only livelihood open to such as I. If you care to listen to me, do. If not, leave with my blessing. Meanwhile, let us see a brisker pace. Why, you said we have nothing to fear, master, protested Ma. "No, I did not." Dushan's voice harshened. "I fear witnessing what will most likely happen to these people whom I helplessly love. The times are evil. We must seek a place apart. And the Dal." They walked onward through the wind. Chapter 3. The Comrade. 1. A ship was loading at the Claudian dock. She was big for an ocean-goer, two-masted, her round black belly taking perhaps 500 tons. The gilt sternpost, curved high over the steering-oar fixtures in the form of a swan's neck and head, also bespoke wealth. Lugo went over to inquire about her. Bound more or less this way, he had turned aside with the idea of seeing what went on at the waterfront. He made it his business to keep fully aware of the world around him. The stevedores were slaves. Though the morning was cool, their bodies gleamed and reeked with sweat as they carried amphoras across the dock and up the gangplank, two men to each great jug. A breeze off the river mingled whiffs of fresh pitch from the ship with their odors. The foreman stood by, and him Lugo could approach. "The Nereid," he replied, "with wine, glassware, silks, and I don't know what else, for Britannia. Their skipper wants to catch tomorrow's early tide. Hoy, you!" His whip flicked across a bare back. It was single-stranded and unloaded, but left a mark between shoulder blade and loincloth. "Move along there!" The slave gave him a hopeless glower and trudged a little faster to his next burden at the warehouse. "Got to freshen 'em pretty often," the foreman explained. "They get out of shape and lazy, sitting around idle. Not enough to do any more." He sighed. "Free men you could lay off in these wretched times and call back when you needed them. But if everybody's in his station for life—" "It's a wonder this vessel is going," Lugo said. "Won't she draw pirates like flies to a carcass? I hear the Saxons and Scotty are turning the shores of Armorica into a blackened desert. The house of the Cedii always was venturesome, and I guess there's a big profit to be made when so few dare sail," the foreman answered. Lugo nodded, stroked his chin, and murmured, "Sea rovers usually do seek their plunder on land. No doubt Nereid will carry guards as well as her crew being armed. If several barbarian craft came in sight, Scotty probably couldn't climb that tall freeboard out of their curraghs, and given any kind of wind, she can show her heels to Saxon galleys. You talk like a mariner yourself, but you don't look like one." The foreman's glance sharpened. Suspicion was the order of the day. He saw a medium-sized, wiry man of youthful appearance, face narrow and high in the cheekbones, curved nose, slightly oblique brown eyes, black hair and a neatly trimmed beard such as was coming into fashion, clean white tunic, blue rain cloak with a cowl shoved back, stout sandals, staff in hand, though he walked lithely. End of side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.